They're the most severe sanctions ever imposed on a single country. Russia says they amount to a declaration of war. As the West expands its measures, will Vladimir Putin be forced to stop his war on Ukraine? And have sanctions worked in the past? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the program. I'm Hazem Seeker. It's been more than 2 weeks since Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine. EU leaders have been meeting in France to talk about more ways to help Ukraine and further punish Russia. But that hasn't stopped the Kremlin from hitting back. Moscow has now imposed an exports ban on a string of products until the end of this year. About 48 countries will be affected, including the US and those in the EU. Russia is already facing the most severe set of Western sanctions ever imposed on a single country. They target a variety of sectors, including oil, banking, aviation, and people close to President Putin.
This is a defining moment for Europe, and it is a moment where we see that Putin's war is also a question of the resilience of democracies. We will rethink energy. We have to get rid of the dependency of Russian fossil fuels. And for that, we need massive investment in renewables. This is also a strategic investment in our security and our independence.
Our Russian President Vladimir Putin says his country will emerge stronger and more independent from Western sanctions, which he said were inevitable.
The pressure of sanctions has always existed. Of course, today it is of a more complicated nature and is posing certain questions, problems, and difficulties on us. But we will overcome them now, just like we have overcome problems in previous years. At the end of the day, all of this will lead to the increase of our independence, autonomy, and sovereignty.
Well, let's take a closer look at the growing number of international companies that have pulled out of Russia. McDonald's, Coca-Cola, and Starbucks are among the latest corporations suspending operations after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Germany's Volkswagen and Japan's Toyota have both halted production in Russia indefinitely. And several tech firms have closed up shop, including software companies Microsoft and SAP. Fashion brands H&M and Zara have also joined the corporate exodus. Well, let's bring in our guests now. Joining us from London, Chris Weefer, Chief Executive Officer at Macro Advisory, a strategic consultancy focused on Russia and Eurasia. In Oslo, Glenn Diesen, Professor of International Relations at the University of Southeastern Norway. And also in London, Tom Burgess, author of the Sunday Times best-selling book, Kleptopia, How Dirty Money is Conquering the World. Good to have you all with us, gentlemen. Chris Weefer, let me start with you. Are these sanctions, as they currently stand, working?
They're starting to have an impact, for sure. Let me just say up front, though, that the sanctions, although very severe, are not likely to lead to a financial collapse or even an economic collapse, as maybe we've seen previously. And that's because Russia has been living under a sanctions regime, which has been tightening ever since 2014. So the economy, to some extent, has built in, if you like, some resilience to sanctions, but not, of course, to the extent we're now seeing. So we are starting to see some companies laying off staff because they cannot get spare parts because of the trade embargo. We're starting to see, of course, high-profile brands like IKEA, McDonald's, and others at least temporarily closing their business in Russia, which is leading to layoffs and then a shortage of goods. So we're starting to see this creeping impact on the economy. But as I say, in terms of financial stability or kind of overall macroeconomic stability, that's not yet at risk and won't be so long as Russia is able to continue exporting key products such as gas or industrial materials and is able to be paid for it. So, you know, in that sense, no collapse, but clearly a deteriorating situation.
Chris, Tom Burgess, what's your take on how effective these sanctions are? What the overall effect of them is?
Well, I think we have to break them into their two parts. There's the sectoral sanctions, as they're known, which is essentially the sort of economic attack reducing purchases of Russian exports like oil and gas, trade embargoes, the kind of things Chris was talking about a moment ago. And then there's the targeted sanctions, which are sort of subtler and harder to read in a way. These are obviously the attacks on the personal wealth of those who have prospered under Putin's kleptocracy for many years. They are being touted as a way to put pressure on him. I would offer a note of skepticism with those as well. I would say the two categories of oligarchs, the 1990s oligarchs who got rich into privatizations and then had their wings clipped rather by Putin and were made dependent on him, but maintain relationships with him. They, I think, have limited influence on his decision-making. And then there's the kind of Putin-era oligarchs who, a lot of whom have, like him, passed in the KGB and were in some cases kind of plucked from obscurity and created by Putin. They have a much greater personal dependency on him. They're also sort of barons of state companies, generally, oil, gas, pipelines, etc., as opposed to private ones. But if the aim of the sanctions is to ultimately to persuade the richest beneficiaries of Russia's kleptocracy that they need a new boss at the top because Putin's policies are proving too ruinous for their wealth, you've got to question that logic as well, because so many of them are so bound up with him that typically, in my experience of covering kleptocracies all over the world, when the big man goes down, those close to him go down with him. So you've got to wonder to what extent they would see it as in their interest to try to remove Putin at any stage.
Yeah, I mean, we can certainly talk more about that a little bit later. But this is related to Britain's decision, isn't it, to put several Russian oligarchs on their sanctions list, because many of them have a lot of their money in UK banks. So, yeah, we'll talk a little bit more of that in a moment. But I want to turn to Glenn Deason and get his take on the sanctions overall. The history of sanctions, as far as having the desired effect of getting the people that they are targeting to change their position or get them to back down, is not a great one, is it? It's checkered at best. Do you expect this to be any different?
No, well, this is the problem often with sanctions. They're put in place because, politicians feel they have to do something, and it's either economic pressure or military pressure. But sometimes, you know, doing something doesn't necessarily mean anything's achieved. Now, when we ask whether or not the sanctions are working, if they're successful, it really depends what we consider the purpose of the sanctions to be. If it is to weaken the Russian economy as a strategic adversary, then I would say, yes, the sanctions are working. If it is to decouple Russia from the European economies, then yes, it's also working. However, one would also have to point out that since 2014, Russia is working towards reorienting its economy from the West towards the East, mainly China, and this will only intensify the process. But typically, when we talk about sanctions, the purpose is to make the adversary change their policy. We're influencing the cost-benefit analysis of Russian actions. But in order to assess the extent to which sanctions will be effective, we really have to say, well, what are Russia's motivation? And I think often we get it very wrong. One gets the impression from the media that Putin just woke up one day in a bad mood, decided to, you know, conquer some new territory. I think it's important to see the Russian perspective on this. And this is that after NATO expansionism, for the past 30 years, Russia said this is a threat to their security. For the past 15 years, they made it very clear that Ukraine's absorption into NATO is an existential threat. So, in other words, this is a red line, and they will effectively risk everything for this. So it's all or nothing. It's a little bit like the United States. We're willing to obliterate Cuba in order to get the Soviets out. So I think it's important to understand this, because if Russia sees this effectively as a defensive war, if you want, or getting NATO away from its borders, then it can't retreat. What would happen if Russia would go back, pull its forces out today with the mood we have in the West? NATO would work moves directly in with weapons and everything else into Ukraine fairly quickly. And again, this is something that Russia cannot do. So I think the Russians are willing to absorb an enormous amount of economic pain, and they're not going to back down because, again, for them, this is an existential threat. It's a red line. So I don't see any future for the sanctions. I think if we want to change, you would have to talk about some security arrangements with Russia.
Okay, Chris Weefer, Putin has said that Russia is strong enough to withstand sanctions and that this will end up hurting the West in the form of higher food and energy prices. Is he right?
Well, we can already see that. Clearly, the price of commodities, key commodities, energy, but also other commodities that Russia is an important supplier of, for example, wheat and other soft products, all of these prices are rising. So it is putting inflationary pressure on the global economy, and therefore that will affect monetary policy policies and will affect the global economy. So he's right in that respect. But to what extent Russia can withstand the pain and how long it can withstand the pain clearly is an open question. Russia, as I said earlier, has made a lot of preparations to be more resilient against sanctions. For example, if we go back to 2013, Russia was entirely dependent on oil price, needed $115 a year to balance its budget. This year, it'll be less than 50, all else being equal. Back then, Russia imported 50% of its food consumption, mostly from Europe or from the West. Now Russia is completely self-sufficient, so there's no risk of any food shortages, certainly basic items on the shelves. And at the start of this year, Russia had built up substantial financial war chest, $630 billion dollars, the fifth highest in the world. And we also note that the central bank has greatly dispersed those reserves. So even though the central bank is now sanctioned and reserves held in Western banks or sanctioning countries, they can't access. But a lot of reserves have been moved to China and moved elsewhere where they can access them. So in that sense, Putin is right in saying that Russia can withstand a lot of pain because he has made the economy a lot more resilient. The banking system, et cetera, is a lot stronger than it used to be. But the critical factor, though, to repeat is so long as Russia is able to export its key commodities, such as gas and other materials, and be paid for them, so long as there are some banks remaining in the SWIFT system, then Russia is earning, by our estimate, at least $30 billion current account surplus every month, because imports have collapsed, so the current account surplus has gone up. And that's a substantial financial lifeline, which means that the government can continue to fund employment subsidies, maintain domestic economic stability, fund social programs, et cetera, pensions, et cetera. And that means this situation in Russia, not ideal, it's not growing, McDonald's have closed, but there really is no danger of an economic or financial collapse. And that probably means that social pressures won't be that much either.
Tom Burgess, going back to the issue around the oligarchs and going after the Russian oligarchs, particularly those, as you said, who are very close to Putin, the later generation. And the thinking here, as you were saying, is that these sanctions will somehow, it's hoped, put the squeeze on them because they've hitched their wagon to Putin up to now, and they might think about turning against him. But could they even weather this financially? Because this is coming more than 2 weeks into this war now. There's been criticism of the British government that they've acted too slow. Would they have had time then to kind of move their money elsewhere so that no one can touch it? I mean, is it too little too late at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I just have to quickly take issue with the idea that
sure, go ahead.
This is a sort of defensive war. I have to take issue with the idea that this is a defensive war. I mean, let's be clear about what the Russian regime is. It's a regime of thieves. You know, Putin, as soon as he came back to St. Petersburg at the end of the Cold War, began enriching himself through corruption, and he's just massively gone on magnifying that process. As Anne Applebaum brilliantly described him as, he's just the first among a group of billionaires, the one who controls the secret police. That's the engine of Putin's regime, is corruption. It's a kleptocracy. It runs on corruption. Now, that means that it requires extraordinary feats of propaganda to maintain control. Part of the propaganda has been these scare stories about the Nazification and the militarization of Ukraine, and this is what's been used as a false pretext for the invasion. Now, it follows from that the motivations of Putin and those around him are, in many senses, material. They're about their own access to wealth and the security that brings. So targeting that wealth is important. As you say, though, the way the West has gone about it, the UK, but also Europe and the US, has been pretty sloppy, especially in the UK. The enormous delay in imposing sanctions when they were obviously coming leads to a lot of anecdotal accounts of, yeah, money being spirited away before names were added to the sanctions list. Further to that, the UK's record of enforcing sanctions is absolutely pitiful. It remains the case that the UK, like the rest of the world, continues to allow this insane idea of financial secrecy, which has become so widespread we've become accustomed to it. But you can, if you're rich enough, participate in a democratic free market economy in disguise behind a front company. So you put a few names on the list and you maybe cause trouble for Chelsea and you grab a few yachts. But we don't know what the Russian kleptocracy is really doing with its wealth because we allow them to move it around in secret. The final point I'd make, and it picks up on something that was raised earlier, is the prospect that this could backfire by accelerating what I called in my book the rise of kleptopia, right? And alliances of kleptocrats, by pushing the Russian kleptocratic elite, but also the economy more generally, into alliances with other ultra-corrupt states. China, Venezuela, Iran, they all wear different kind of ideological masks, but essentially they're all, the political systems are all engines for the enrichments of the powerful. And the more we use sanctions, Donald Trump used them incredibly liberally, the more we use them, the bigger the club of outcasts get, and the more that club of outcasts band together. And if you throw everyone out, then sanctions ultimately become pointless because there's an alternative economy that people can operate in.
Let's talk a little bit more about the potential economic blowback on this in a little more widely. Glenn Deason, is there a real danger that these sanctions will end up hurting too many people, too many ordinary people in the West in the form of inflation, higher energy prices, which we're already seeing now?
Well, yeah, energy, food production, I think a lot of this, in all these areas, you're going to see much higher prices. But then energy is a very interesting area because once energy prices goes up, everything else has to go up. So I think it's going to be very hard to control this. And it has to be pointed out that this is why the Europeans have been very cautious to follow the American lead on this, to have this, to these very strict sanctions, which effectively burns all bridges with Russia. And I think there's also other problems that are coming down the road because, as the previous speaker mentioned, one of the problems with sanctions is obviously if they're too harsh and endures for too long, the one you're punishing simply learns to live without you. They find alternatives. And I think there's too many countries now being sanctioned from China, Russia, Iran. I think a lot of these countries have an incentive now to establish a parallel economic infrastructure, which they already are. They are seeking to cut off from the Western technologies, Western industries, want to use their transportation corridors, their banks, the US dollar, SWIFT. I mean, there have been created alternatives for all of this. And of course, they still have a lot of work to be done. But this is obviously the trend. So you can only use the sanctions for so long. But beyond how the sanctions directly on Russia will affect the West, you also have to keep in mind that China and other countries are also watching as well, because this is becoming a case study in what might happen to them in the future. So if you're sitting in Beijing now, would you want to be vulnerable by having dependence on the dollar, on using SWIFT, holding U.S. debt in your real estate, using American technologies, its banks? Certainly, you are now making preparation to cut off from America to reduce, and Europe to a lesser extent, to reduce your vulnerability. So this is the situation we're in with these excessive sanctions. Any economic dependence become effectively weaponized by the adversary. So with the harshness of these sanctions, I don't think there's been properly thought how this could play out. Also, just on the final point, how is Russia going to respond now? Again, sanctioning the Russian central bank, this is very extreme stuff. Now we can see Russia might start to seize more Western assets. It can nationalize certain assets. It can cut oil and gas deliveries and instead focus on Asia. It can withdraw patents on businesses and simply take over companies that are leaving. I'm not sure if it's possible with McDonald's, for example, simply to save the workplaces and just make one big final divorce from the West and just decide its future lies with the East instead, away from the NATO countries.
Yeah, let's put that to Chris Weaver. I mean, Glenn Deason brings up a point there that Russia has weapons of its own economically and can respond in kind. I mean, how damaging could that be for the countries that are targeting Russia?
Yeah, of course, this is if this were to happen, it would be enormously damaging for the global economy, because you just have to look at a map and see that Russia is the major kind of commodity supplier for the world, not just oil and gas, but wheat. Ukraine and Russia were the two biggest producers of wheat, and Ukraine exports are now, of course, disrupted. But also coal, nickel, palladium, and all sorts of materials. So if Russia, if those exports from Russia were to stop, then clearly the global economic impact would be very severe, and we'd have a global recession. But it's important to bear in mind that, you know, at least as it stands right now, President Putin and other people around him continue to say that Russia will continue to honor all export contracts. Now, of course, what they're saying is that, particularly to Europe, if Europe continues to buy Russian gas as per the contract and the volumes and the pricing, then Russia will continue to supply. And for example, every Gazprom every day, sends an update that it is, sending gas through all the various routes, including across Ukraine, every day as per the contract. And this was the same in the Soviet Union. There was never a supply disruption. So I think that, you know, essentially what Russia is saying, that provided you keep paying us, and the routes for which we can be paid, such as some banks in the SWIFT system, then we will keep supplying. But they clearly never lose an opportunity to remind the rest of the world just how dependent the global economy is on Russian commodities. Talking about the question of nationalization, that is key important also, because when you talk about companies like, say, Coca-Cola or other brands, they're essentially Russian companies. They employ Russian people, and they source their product mostly in Russia. Now, IKEA and a few others are different. That's why IKEA had to close quite quickly, because it could not import flat pack furniture, etc. But in the case of McDonald's and other companies that are sourcing their materials inside the country are essentially Russian companies in terms of employment and paying taxes, then what the Russian government is saying is that they want those companies to stay, they prefer them to stay, and actually they're offering incentives for companies to stay, even recognizing that some companies are under global consumer or stakeholder pressure to temporarily close. They're accepting that, they're acknowledging that, but they still want to them to stay. But if they choose to go, if companies say we are now exiting Russia, we are not coming back, then the Russian government has said that their businesses could be nationalized because they want to protect Russian jobs, or the assets could be confiscated and sold elsewhere. And then just very quickly aligned with that, we have seen China already saying that their big companies are now actively looking at asset acquisition opportunities, particularly in strategic sectors such as energy or materials. They will be a keen buyer for any Western assets to become available, and Russia will accommodate that.
All right. Just turning back then to Tom Burgess on what's probably going to be the last word on this. Coming back to the oligarchs, is there a kind of, if you look at the optics of this, is there a sort of messaging problem that the West has with Ukrainians in that, you know, what's going after a few Russian billionaires going to do for the millions of Ukrainians who are suffering right now, that you know, they've got enough money to weather this. So what kind of, I mean, do you think there's a messaging issue there in terms of showing Ukraine that the West is fully behind them?
Yeah, and actually I think it goes much further than that. I think you read the statement that the UK and other Western governments have made to accompany their sanctions decisions to justify why Igor Sechin or Oleg Deripaska or Roman Abramovich or whoever is going on this list. And there's very little information, as far as I can see, in any of those that we didn't know a week ago, a month ago, a year ago, that we didn't know in some cases back when Putin murdered Litvinenko on the streets of London, or more pointedly, we didn't know when Putin annexed Crimea in 2014. But up until now, our decision has essentially been, you know what, we'd rather keep the money. And I think there is a mismatch in what we're doing now and what the Ukrainians might feel they could demand of us.
Unfortunately, that's going to have to be the last word. We're out of time. Thank you to all three of you, Chris Wiefer, Glenn Deason and Tom Burgess. Thanks very much for being on Inside Story. And thank you, as always, for watching. Remember, you can see this program again anytime. Just go to our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com. com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle there is @AJInsideStory. For me, Hazem Sika, and the entire team here, bye for now.